And now let's. I'm going to introduce our speaker. This person's someone I've come to respect a lot. I know that if there's someone who needs help, I can give her number out, or I can give her sponsees numbers out because I have their permission. And when I send people to them, they're going to be just fine because I know that they work a program out of the big book. They're very active in service work, and this woman's got one heck of a spirituality. So please help me welcome Suzanne.
My name is Suzanne. I'm an alcoholic. It's great seeing a group of young people. It's pretty magical. My sobriety date is August 18th of 1987. I got sober when I was 23. And, I'm 49. You too can become a... They now tell me I'm an old-timer, so I guess that's what the hell I am. I'm really glad to be here today and to share the message of sobriety with you, and my stomach is just twisting right now, so I'll get in my groove in a few minutes. Just wait for God to kick in. I was thinking on the way over here today, if you had told me 25 years ago that I would still be here sober, I would tell you that I would probably have money against it, because my track record of trying to do anything for any amount of time as a drunk was not real good. And I didn't have a desire to get sober the first time I was introduced to AA, which, by the way, is a pretty interesting story. My first introduction to AA was 2 dates after a blind date. He took me to an AA meeting. And so that tells you what kind of chick I was. I mean, my whole thing was, let's get drunk, then we'll get to know each other, maybe. And so that was my first introduction to AA. I was 19, and I was already, gone, pretty much gone. Everything that everyone was doing in their life, going to school, connecting with people, having things in their life going on, my life had no resemblance to that, and I will tell you that that was not my dream as a kid. I'm the youngest of 7 children, originally from New York. We moved a bunch growing up. It seemed like every 3 years we were packing up and moving on, and I will tell you that I believe in many ways my insecurity around being with people had a lot to do with that. We never were in any place for any amount of time, so right when I'd get to know you, we were moving. So I learned very early on just to kind of keep my distance from people and not to connect to them. I will also share that when I was about 12, the brother-in-law that eventually married into the family was the person that molested me for many years. So I walked around feeling, at the age of 12 on, like damaged goods. It was something I used to never share at the podium, but I believe today I share that not for an effect, but for just give you the picture of who this person is and what's made me me. I'm not ashamed of it anymore. I don't feel like dirt. And I just believe that's the result of finally working the program and digging in. But I will tell you, for a long time, my behavior showed someone completely different than the person standing in front of you. My first drunk, I remember better than my first boyfriend. And I will tell you that it was magical. We were living up in Canada. I BS'd my way to a little event with the school, telling everyone I knew how to ski. Now, we had just moved from Florida to Canada. I had never been on skis. I had no concept of what skis were, how you put the boots on. And it was obvious 10 minutes into the day. But we got to the top of the mountain, and someone had a flask, and they started passing it around, and the flask stayed with me. I remember taking a swig on it, it going down, it burning, and all of a sudden I started getting taller, feeling stronger, feeling in charge. It was magical. And I kept doing it from that point on. I love to tell you that I chased the drunk for 10 years. There were other recreational activities, but this is an AA meeting, and I always try to keep it on primary purpose. So if you think I'm just a pure drunk, I am, but I'm also a pure drunk that tried everything I could to try to change the way I felt. So, you know, the thing that I think is so amazing when I look back is that here's a kid, 13 years old, already getting pie-eyed. That's the only thing I knew that felt right to me. You know, going to school felt very awkward. Connecting with the family that I grew up with was very awkward for me. I'm carrying a big secret around. Can't tell anyone. I always had to put on the show. So I learned quick how to become the actress. You know, the actress with the drink. Pure joy is what I thought it was. When I was about 19, I will tell you that my drinking really took off. I had graduated high school. Wasn't sure what I wanted to be when I grew up. Thought maybe for a minute I wanted to become a nun. So I know. I didn't have the credentials, I will tell you, in the biblical sense. And so I thought, well, maybe I should become a nun. Now, I think I already knew something wasn't wiring right with me. And, of course, I'm packing my bag, and I think my mother's kind of overjoyed but freaked out. And maybe she's thinking this is going to change me. And as I'm packing my bag, and she's putting her little Bible in there and the rosary beads, yes, Brian, rosary beads, I start packing the bottles as she leaves the room. And so I have a suitcase primarily just laden down with bottles and some clothes. And that lasted about 3 months, and back home I came. I had no clue what I wanted to be when I grew up. I will just tell you that, you know, I had friends, drinking friends. There was two girls in high school that I was pretty close with when we finally moved back to the States. But I didn't know how to connect to these people. I mean, we'd go out drinking, you know, we'd go and play the game of drinking, as I like to call it. We'd drink, and then they would leave at a reasonable hour, and I would show up home when my body found its way home, or when I came to on a beach, or in another city, and went, oh my God, I'm not here at home. I mean, that's how I drank. I was a blackout drinker. And I just missed these friends. You know, they had no value to me. And I think that's the thing that I've begun to realize about alcohol. Is alcohol really robbed me of any sense of self or self-worth or having to be of purpose to anyone in their life. I went into outside sales because I was a good drunk. Without an education, I thought, well, what do you do when you grow up? I'm supposed to make money. I'm supposed to be someone. So I got into sales, which was a great job. Always had two briefcases. One with paperwork, one with bottles. And, you know, it was kind of crazy. I'd go to work for a couple hours. I would leave to go on calls. And I'd always find my way to this place in Tampa called Jimmy Mac's. Jimmy Mac's would open early, supposedly for eating, but I didn't know that. And they had a great bar, and I knew the bartenders, and I would sit there, and I would daydream about what I wanted to be when I grew up. And then I'd go back to the office, a couple sheets away from being sober, and within no time, you know, they picked up on who they were dealing with. I can tell you that when I finally got sober and my sponsor said, let me look at your resume, there were more jobs within like a 3-year span. I think there was like 15 jobs, you know, and it was always their fault. Never put two and two together that it had anything to do with my drinking. I met this guy when I was selling, and, you know, like minds meet like minds, right? You're at a bar, you always find a good drunk like you are, and he drank like I drank, and he was going to Miami. He was going to go on this big deal in Miami, and I got to tell you that I knew I was wearing out my welcome. I was still living at home. You know, we talk big, but we live at home for free, and that's the way I was. And I was getting tired of my parents questioning me. You know, always questioning me, trying to take me to a psychiatrist to try to figure out why this child of theirs seemed irrational, crazy, and just a mental deformity. And I remember sitting in a psychiatrist's office with my parents, and my parents were saying, something is wrong with her. And I'd be like, nothing's wrong with me. They tried to put me on medication. I read the label. Don't take with alcohol. Didn't take the medication. I mean, hello. That went. And, you know, the one thing I know my dad was trying to do was trying to find me a good husband. It seemed like the only person that ever set me up on a blind date was my dad. And three times he tried. And the one guy was the guy that took me to my first AA meeting. Now, I will tell you that it's probably not a good sign on your second or third date that you're being taken to an AA meeting from, you know, a guy that's just met you. But I didn't know he was sober. He had been sober 7 years, so the poor schmuck got hooked up with this broad. And I'm sure my dad had to go make an amends to him. I know I did. But you know, I will tell you something that's kind of amazing. That's the first seed of AA that was planted in my life. I wasn't ready. I remember walking into that little dingy-ass clubhouse in Tampa going, where's the bar? And why am I here? I wasn't ready. I wasn't done. Now, this guy wanted me to be done, but I wasn't done. And I remember leaving, telling him I was going to a bar down the street, and he came and picked me up. But in a weird sort of way, the seed had been planted. It almost started screwing my drinking up. Because I kind of realized at that point I couldn't play denial. Now I did for a number of more years, but I couldn't play denial. It's almost like it screwed it up. I moved to Miami and, you know, a con artist, a bullshitter. I moved to a nice big condo on a golf course. Never played golf, had no furniture, but I had the right address. I had blow-up furniture and folding-out lawn chairs in the house. And that was it. I think I had like 4 plates, maybe, a couple cups. I mean, no like mojo going on in that place other than the bottles. You know, cases of beer and bottles of, you know, scotch, because that was my drink of choice near the end. I remember my dad coming to visit once, and he walked in, and he's like, does this feel abnormal to you in here? And I'm like, no. You have no furniture. So? I mean, it just seemed normal to me. I mean, I look back today, and it's just insane. My drinking in Miami took a real turn for the worse. I will tell you that I was not safe for anyone. I just wasn't. I started stealing at work. I was stealing money. I started stealing time from them. I would go in and just make it look like I knew what the hell I was doing, and in a very short while they knew. And there was a guy there that I used to go drinking with, and I thought he drank like I drank. At least everyone looked like they drank like I drank after a couple drinks, you know. I was just more concerned with my drinking. And he called me into his office one day and he says, hey, I have a phone number for you. I want you to use this phone number. It's really important you call. Now, I will tell you at this point, I was running out of cash, like any drunk. And, well, I ran out of cash and I made my brother move me in the middle of the night to this little place in South Miami because the place I was living in, there was more eviction notices than, you know, visitors. And I started, like, bumming more money from my family, from friends. If you were at a bar and you put your tip money down and you turned, it was my money. I mean, I did whatever I could to drink. I had no sense of worth. I mean, it was all about drinking to me. And so I go to this guy's office, and we sit down, and he's like, please call this number. Okay. So I go back to my office, and I dial the number, and the person on the other end goes, the club. Hell? What is this? Alcoholics Anonymous. This guy was a black belt Al-Anoner. And he knew a drunk when he spotted a drunk. It wasn't really hard to figure me out. See, I was the chick that would start drinking when everyone left the office so I could get kind of primed up for prime time. Except sometimes I get too primed up that I just go in my car and fall asleep in it. And I'd be so total, I wouldn't wake up until the morning. And as people were pulling in and seeing me sleep in the car. And so they knew something wasn't right. She has a house, you know. She's in the car in Miami in Hialeah in the early 80s. Not really safe. She has the same outfit on from the day before. Something's not right. Something's not wired right. Well, I hung that phone up, I've got to tell you, but I kept the number. And it just went downhill, you know. I wasn't invited to my parents' house anymore. I mean, the last birthday that they had for me, when I showed up 3 hours late, drunk, they put the gift out on the front porch. They put the half-eaten cake on the front porch. And when I walked in, they said, "You're not welcome." And that's just how I was. You know, I've got to tell you that when I started drinking, it did magic for me. There was something magical about drinking. I felt secure. I felt pretty. I felt comfortable with myself. And at the end, I felt like I was dying. I just felt like I was dying. Even like the quality of prospects that you meet at the bar, you know, at the dankiest bars, were even going, "We can't be around you." I mean, I was dating... Okay, I was having an affair with this guy. Let's just call it what it is. And he drank like I drank. And, you know, we would show up at my apartment at like 2 in the afternoon because he needed to get home, of course, for later. And we would go drinking, and then we'd meet in the morning to have a couple drinks before we'd go to work, because there's always those bars that stay open a lot of hours in Miami. And we were sitting there one day, and this is my third flag of AA showing up in my life, and he said, "Suzanne, I don't know about you, but AA didn't work for me, but I think AA could work for you." I was 22, you know? I was like already out there, gone. You know, when the old guy, and he was an old guy, I mean, not many young guys wanted to be with me. He had money, let's be real, so I know I could get my drinks. When they don't even want to be around you, there's something wrong. You know, there's something horribly wrong. You know, near the end of my drinking, my first end, I thought, I was the chick that lived in that real shitty-ass apartment. I always kept the lights on all night because I started having panic attacks and thinking someone was coming to get me. I'm not really sure who. And the apartments were so close that the people in the other building would throw crap at my window and say, "Turn your lights off. Turn the music off. Stop talking to yourself." I mean, I was just out there, completely out there. I called the number one day that guy had given me from work. Now, I still kept the job. I don't know how. And I called them up, and I thought I was so freaking original. I said, "Look, I'm calling for a friend." We always call for friends or loved ones. And I said, "You know, I need the books," because I didn't know what this was, really. I thought you took classes. And they said, "Why don't you come visit us?" First of all, no one had invited me over in a long time, so I thought that was pretty cool. And what I didn't know, it was the place that I always thought was like cutting chicken heads, because there's always people outside of it. And they were always out there drinking and smoking and chatting, and they looked real happy. I thought there was a little activity going on in this place. And it was the clubhouse. It was the Coral Gable room. So I drove over there, and I remember walking in petrified. Petrified. Of course, I had to have a couple to get there. People were smiling. I mean, now this place was gray walls, you know, the AA motif. Gray walls or green walls, you know, we always have those clubhouses. The couch, when you sit in it, you get stuck. You know. They didn't even have nice little folding chairs. They were real, the old wooden ones. And but they all looked happy. They all looked happy. So I walked in and so I just called and they said, well, why don't you stay for a meeting? I can't. I have plans. But I stayed there for about 15 minutes and I remember just thinking, this is the first time in a long time I saw people that were actually smiling, actually like greeted me, shook my hands, said, hope we see you again. Now, I haven't heard that in a long time. So it almost like floored me. It took me by surprise. I will tell you, I showed up there 3 days later. I guess I was in a blackout from what I was told. And that would kind of become the cycle for me for a year. I'd love to tell you that I got there, I surrendered, and I got busy. I got there, and I kept drinking because I was not yet convinced that I was an alcoholic. I thought I was too young. Girls can't be alcoholics. Now, mind you, I come from a history of all alcoholics. You know, the alcoholic aunt, you know, that always had her pills and her bottles, and I would go through their suitcases. Like, you weren't safe coming to my house when I was a kid because I'd go through your suitcase. And, you know, I would always see what she had. And there was just all alcoholics in my family. But why I thought I was not eligible for the adventure is beyond me. So here I am, going to AA meetings, and I was the one you needed to be safe from. I was the one that would show up and I would bounce off cars to find the right parking space. I was the one that would show up and pick up my 60-day chip when really I had just had a few drinks. And they knew it. And they'd like go, here's your white chip. And I remember chairing a meeting. I told someone that I had, you know, the requirements. I had 90 days sober. And I wanted to chair this meeting because it had a microphone. I can tell you that the mic moved in about 10 minutes of me sharing, and they knew. But there was two people that really made an impression on me. There was this old guy named Coach, and Coach was a coach back in the day. And he always would see me and he'd always say, someday you're going to get this thing, and if you stay long enough, it will get beyond your wildest dreams. Now I got to tell you something. I was living in a rat hole. I knew I was weeks away from losing a job. I had no money. I mean, I bought a car in a blackout, you know, so no wonder I had no money. I mean, I got a phone call one day from the dealership going, hey, you need to come pick your car up. I looked out the window and my car's there. They said, no, you bought a car last night. I'm like, oh, shit. So no wonder I had no money. You know, I was doing stupid crap. Coach always would say that to me. Stay around. You may get this thing. My last drunk, I don't know. It was not your typical chick night out. There was a guy that was blackmailing me that I worked with. He had some stuff on me. And I went to his house to have a discussion. And we started drinking. And by the end of the night, we had a fist fight. I lost. And pushed out of a car. You know, your typical night out of drinking, right? I always love these commercials when the chick is sitting there with on the couch, you know, with a little sippy-sippy. Never did I do that. Sippy-sippy was a big bottle between the legs that I would sit there and like shove back. There was nothing pretty about me when I was drinking. You know, I didn't like have nice clothes when I was drinking. I always had the burn mark clothes, you know. The suit that had the little red wine stained, but no one would notice because I didn't know about dry cleaners. That was not a priority. I mean, I was just a mess. But that night, I've got to tell you, was my turning point. I guess I drove in a blackout from North Miami to South Miami, and I ended up at the AA clubhouse. I always like to say that I believe that that was a God thing. That this drunk really didn't know where she was going, but I believe at that point God was working in my life. They found me in my car. I guess I was trying to get out, and I started choking on my vomit. And that night they rushed me to the hospital. It wasn't my first hospital visit. I mean, most of us have been to the hospital. If we haven't yet, that's always one of those you're eligible to if you keep drinking. When I came to in the morning, I really believe they did this on purpose. They took my bed and they put it near this two-way mirror. And I remember rolling over and going, who the is that? It was like I hadn't even seen myself in years. And I will tell you that I believe I didn't. You know, I didn't want to look at myself in the mirror. I didn't want to look at myself inside. And I looked down at me and, of course, you know, torn clothes, black eye, blood. It was just beautiful. Beautiful night out of drinking. The doctor walked in and she looked at me and she said, I have one thing to say to you. If you continue drinking, the next time I see you, you will be in a body bag. Your body is going. Now, I'd heard things like that before. You know, body bag, you're sick, something's wrong, you need help. But for whatever reason that morning when I came to and I heard that and I saw me, it was the first time I said to myself, I'm done. I always love the part when we read about the methods we have tried. I tried a lot of them. I tried to read the book and thinking if I read the book, I'd get this thing. I wouldn't have to go to meetings. I wouldn't have to deal with you people. Maybe I could get sober. I had no clue what it meant. They said there were 10 people of AA waiting outside in the waiting room. That's what you people do. That's what we do as alcoholics. When the suffering alcoholic is done, we wait and we run in and help. They took me home, cleaned me up, they took me to a meeting. When I got home, my parents called. Now, I will tell you, my parents hadn't called in a long time. And I told them what happened. They invited me home. It took me 3 days to get from Miami to Lakeland. I had to go detox in a hotel room somewhere. I didn't know at this point I had been fired from my job, so it shows you how much I showed up to that place. And I started the journey. That was August 19th of 87 was, I believe, really my first day walking out. The 18th was when I finally was done. But I believe the 19th is when I started my first step of living this thing. I will tell you that steps 1, 2, and 3 for me, I believe in some ways started in that hospital. For me, step 1 is about surrender and having to look at my unmanageability. And I saw it that morning. You know, I saw the destruction that I befell on many people in my life, the way I treated people, the hurt that I did for people, you know, the lying, the cheating, the stealing. I mean, I had it all covered. But I was done. I was really done. And I can't tell you that I believed that I was going to stay sober. I just will tell you that I believed that I didn't want to drink anymore. And I think that was my beginning. The first guy that I ever met in AA that tore me a new one, because you know there's always those in AA that go MF. Because that's what he was. I was at a meeting. I had just gone to my first AA meeting in Lakeland. And they asked if there was any visitors. Of course, I raised my hand. Any newcomers? I am not raising my hand. And they said, well, why don't you come up and share your story? Oh, well, I would love to. A good alcoholic with an ego. So I walk up to the podium. And I think I shared for a few moments, and they said, well, thank you so much for sharing. And they whisked me back to my chair, and this guy came up to me afterwards and said, I want you to meet someone. I think it'll be good for them. Now, I am like 5 days without a drink, and I'm thinking I'm going to help someone. And I'm shaking. You know, I got the burnt suit on because I want to look good for the meeting. The high heels with the nails sticking out because we don't know about cobblers and all that shit. The stolen beeper. Okay, this is the 80s, so we didn't have cell phones. The stolen beeper from the job that I had just left. I wanted to look important, you know. And I was like, oh, okay, I'd love to meet her. And he goes, yeah, she needs a good sick one to work with. That woman became my sponsor. And I will tell you, the gift she gave me was the gift of surrender. She taught me how to let go and let God. And not by anything other than doing some action. Look, I don't know what I believed when I got here. I was raised in a spiritual home, but the first toga on a drink, that was the God of my understanding. She kept it real simple. She said, all you need to believe is that we believe, and if you trust the process, you will be contacted. And that for me is really what's happened. You know, I went through the steps with her. Every night she made my tail end go to her house. We'd go through the book together. We'd sit down. We'd start working through the steps. And she gave me enough rope to hang my silly ass. She really did. And I'm grateful for that. You know, step three was the step that really just threw me for a loop, and I complicated the crap out of it. And everyone was afraid of five. I was afraid of three. I was afraid of letting go, and I was afraid of what was going to become of me if I let go. And for me, step three was really kind of a magical thing. I believe it was the first encounter with the God of my understanding, my higher power. And what it was I went on a search looking for God, because obviously he was lost. And I went to synagogues, I went to Catholic church, I did, you know, I got dip-dunked, I did, like, chanting, you know. I went to an Indian shaman trying to, you know, evoke whatever, I'm not sure what I was looking for. But I was so afraid of drinking. I've got to tell you, I was petrified of drinking. It was the first time in my life I was sober, sober taking a shower, sober driving a car, sober interacting with another human being, sober working. It was all new. And I was afraid that if I got in the way, I was going to get drunk again. And I remember going to her house going, I'm screwed. I can't find this God that you keep talking about or this higher power. I'm screwed. She said, that is the smartest damn thing you said. And at that point, she pulled out her big book, and she said, get on your knees. Okay. Thought I was going to get flogging or something. She said, we're going to do the third step prayer. You're done. You're ready. And we did. It's the first time I had prayed with someone since I was 5 years old. It was very awkward. It was scary as shit. But it was the most freeing thing that I have ever experienced in my life. I'd love to tell you that the last 25 years have been an easy go of it. I will tell you that the basis that I got back when I was early in my sobriety still works today. I have tried to complicate this thing along the way. I've tried to change it up, because I'm human, to suit me, and it has always cracked me in the ass. And what I mean by that is, when I start doing my program, I'm not following directions. I'm not living a life that I was intended to live. I believe, you know, through sobriety I've been able to walk through anything. And the thing that's really helped me is that I know I have people in my life today that love me. I have friends that have been with me. When I had cancer, they all piled in and stepped up and supported me through the process. When I lost my job Friday, they have been there. And that's what happened Friday. I walked in and they walked me out. Not because of drinking today. That's a good thing. I just believe I can walk through anything today, and it's not because of anything that I feel egotistical about. I just believe that I surrendered and keep surrendering to God's grace, that I know that this thing is going to be all right. Do I like it? Hell no, it sucks. You know? It's not what I intended on Friday, but it is what it is. I also know that for me, still being convinced today that a drink won't solve it is still at the forefront of my mind. I'm convinced that a drink won't solve my problems today. I'm also convinced that bullshitting you about where I'm at won't keep me safe and sober. I believe that today. You know, the thing for me is that walking through sobriety has been a gift that I never knew was possible. About a year and a half ago, my sponsor passed away. And I share this because, you know, we're all given those guides along the way. And I know I was watching everyone prior to, you know, the meeting, and it was just fun to watch, you know, people handing each other eggs and everyone doing their powwow and getting ready. And it's awesome, you know. That's what sobriety is about. We are not a glum lot. I mean, look around this room today. We're sober. We're all sober. And that woman was one of my guides on this path. She had, at the time of her death, 30 years of sobriety. She packed heat. She always would remind me, don't forget, I pack heat. She did. She drove a Corvette, so I'm aspiring to her someday. I'm not sure about the heat yet, but I want that. And she was mighty. She was mighty because she just told it like it was. But the thing that this gift of sobriety was doing for me during that year of watching her pass was it sustained me. That woman and I talked for hours about sobriety. She talked about getting sober and about doing the deal. You know, she talked about the rough times and how we stay the course. We, not me, not you, we. And I think the thing that she gave me the best gift with is that the day she passed, I knew I was not alone. You know, I knew that the people of AA were going to carry me. And you did. That was the hardest death I've ever gone through in my sobriety. So for me, I still have a sponsor today. I still go to meetings. You know, I stumble, I fall, I make mistakes. I don't do this thing perfectly. And I am only aware of one thing, is that today is the only day I have. That's it. I'd love to be figuring out what's going on 2-3 weeks from now. Am I going to get a job? Not get a job? What am I going to be when I grow up? I can't worry about that, you know? I can't worry about what people are going to think. All I know is that if I stay sober today, anything is possible. So thank you very much for allowing me to share my story.